Welcome to This Rhetorical Life, a podcast dedicated to the practice, pedagogy, and public circulation of rhetoric in our lives. In this episode, we're taking a look at the rhetoric of Occupy Wall Street and talking with Dennis Traynor Jr., the filmmaker of a new documentary called American Autumn about the movement. We're your hosts, Carrie Ann Soto
and Ben Kiebrick. There are many rhetorical issues to explore through the Occupy Wall Street movement. The framing of the 99% versus the 1%, materialist physical rhetorics of occupying space, and so on. And we'll get at those. But it's also important to note that the most commonly stated victory of the Occupy movement is a rhetorical one. That is, we often hear about the movement changing the national conversation. Todd Gitlin, sociologist at Columbia, for instance, writes in his new book, Occupy Nation, that the sort of sea change in public conversation that took 3 years to develop in the long-gone 60s about brutal war, unsatisfying affluence, debased politics, and the suppressed democratic promise took 3 weeks in 2011.
At its base, then, a social movement like Occupy Wall Street is about the story it can tell. Let's start with a clip from the film, where Vlad Teichberg of the Occupy Wall Street Media Group talks about the exigency of the movement and the importance of story and framing. He says that while some are trying to keep the issues confined
to an economical crisis, it's also a crisis of morals and it's a crisis of values. The big part of it is storytelling. Ability to tell the story and propagate it to the greater world in various ways pretty much determines whether certain ideas survive or get buried under the onslaught of propaganda.
Before a local screening of his new film, American Autumn, I sat down with Dennis Traynor Jr. We're talking to him as a filmmaker, but also as a very early participant in the movement. Even though, as Traynor Jr. mentions,
I should say what everyone in the Occupy movement will say is I am certainly not the leader of or the spokesperson for any Occupy anything.
He's not the leader, but he was there at the very beginning of the Occupy movement, which started in
April or March of 2011. I started working with a group called the October 2011 Coalition. The October 2011 Coalition was a group inspired by the Wisconsin Wave and inspired by Tahrir Square and the Arab Spring, was calling for and organizing around an indefinite occupation of public space in Washington, D.C. that was going to start on October 6th of 2011. We chose that date because many in this October 2011 Coalition were longstanding members of one faction or another of the peace movement, the anti-war movement. And October 6th happened to be the eve of what would be the beginning of our second decade, the 11th year of our occupation of Afghanistan. Uh-huh. It was also the eve of a congressional session that promised debates around austerity. So we were trying to bring all these ideas under a big tent. Mm. And we were doing it not like what started to happen in New York later, where anarchists were organizing horizontally autonomous groups to get things done. That was kind of a buzzword, but really still we were operating in an older model, a more top-down kind of organizational model, where leaders who have specific skill sets and specific expertise were taking on leadership roles in the areas of their expertise or skill sets. One of the things that I did was video. So I started helping, instead of being a policy wonk, I started helping them create promotional videos for this. Mm-hmm. And they were starting to become a little bit of momentum surrounding this October 2011 event. This is before Adbusters put out the call for mm-hmm. Occupy Wall Street. So I'm married and I have two kids, and I just thought the revolution was going to start on October 6th in Freedom Plaza. So I said to my wife, I'm going to go live in a tent in Washington, D.C. for a month, and I'm going to make it. I'm going to make a documentary.
But as Traynor explained, then something big happened.
Obviously, during the organization of all that, Occupy Wall Street sprang up, and the movie that I was going to make, which was going to be called Taking Freedom Plaza, became just one chapter in a much, much, much bigger story, over 900 encampments all over the country.
To get at the story that Occupy tells, the argument it makes, we have to understand the framing of the problem.
And as George Lakoff argued in an article about the rhetoric of the movement, it is a consciously moral framing.
The old cliche is human needs before corporate greed. But the idea that when is enough, you know, that constant growth is not sustainable. This quarterly kind of shareholder capitalism where, you know, if you're running a company, you have to answer to shareholders every quarter and constantly grow is literally a homicidal force, right? So that concept literally stops us from getting Medicare for all, for example, which literally kills almost 18,000 people a year. That's 6 9/11s. So that's the Twin Towers coming down 6 times every effing year. Now, if the government knew that we were going to get attacked a 6-time scale 9/11 next year, I think we would pass several Patriot Acts. We would lock a lot of people up. We would go to town to do it. But we know that next year in 2013, about 18,000 people are going to die because they don't have access to health care. That's insane.
And Trainer explains this problem stemming in part from the ideology of meritocracy, the American dream story we've all been told.
I think that, you know, the American dream has been, you know, for better or for worse, described as, you know, this myth of this kind of rags to riches, you know, everyone in the middle class, which both the Democrats and the Republicans seem to love and court, seem to think that they're temporarily embarrassed millionaires, right? And that's why a more kind of, not socialism or communism per se exactly lifted, but elements of those kind of philosophies aren't embedded in our society because everyone feels like if I just work a little harder, then I could be a millionaire.
And that, of course, gets us to a critique of capitalism.
Right? So that's the big elephant in the room, you know, mm-hmm. is the capitalist structure that we organize ourselves under as a society, right? If we could press the reset button, would we organize ourselves that way?
This critique isn't necessarily new. What Occupy brought is a new way of telling the story and organizing around these issues, a new public rhetoric of protest.
And a new way, a new tactic of thinking. One of my favorite quotes in the movie is Medea Benjamin, a friend of mine from Code Pink, who said,
thanks to Occupy Wall Street, there's a lot of new ways of organizing, which is not just calling people to participate in something you came up with, but giving people the opportunity to create themselves and to be part of the original brainstorming about what to do so that they feel empowered in this movement. It's also, I think, finally put the kibosh on let's organize a rally on a Saturday in Washington, D.C. when everything is closed and people come from around the country and spend a lot of money to walk around in a circle and then go home.
Occupy is about living our demands. So while the younger crowd that sprung up in Zuccotti Park in Occupy Wall Street was trying to say, we're going to just live a model of the kind of world that we want to create.
So the difference that Trainer Jr. and Medea Benjamin emphasize is that the process of decision making is different, and this matters. It's what David Graeber and others call prefigurative politics, what Trainer Jr. is calling here living our demands. It is a notion that the means and the ends are exactly the same. Instead of demanding something from a power holder, they're just going to start living the world they would be demanding. And this happened in the physical occupation of Zuccotti Park. For instance, where they model that everyone can be cared for in this society by caring for everyone in the park, and by practicing a capacious participatory democracy there.
But is this just a short-term tactic that has lost its power? Is this occupying the public space the only means to the argument?
Certainly, the Occupy movement has never been about the right to occupy public space. It's a tactic to draw attention, to engage in dialogue. So I think that that's what happened. And I don't think that that particular tactic of occupying public space indefinitely is going to happen again. I think you'll see it kind of flash mob style, like we're going to occupy the Capitol building for a weekend or a week to draw attention to specific matters. But the idea that we're going to just set up camp and stay there indefinitely I don't think it's going to happen again. Of course, Occupy has still been doing the things they've been doing since September 17th, but because the encampments, the indefinite physical occupations are no longer there, that there's not a visible component to what they do. So there might be some thinking around what's that doing, but what happens is that small groups, empowered by the concepts and the theories of Occupy, set off on autonomous actions.
Obviously, the most visible slogan, the thing that has entered daily discussion, is the notion of the 99% and the 1%. So on the idea of this movement being a movement of the 99%, Trainer Jr. says,
clearly, clearly it's a wish and not an articulation of where the movement is, right? But clearly when I've been arrested twice in the movement, and it provides opportunities for you to talk with people who have arrested you. There's a lot of paperwork to get done. So the police officers in Washington, D.C. were working without a contract and working without a pension. So we can talk about them and talk about these things. In Tahrir Square, you could have had all those people out in the streets, but until the military stepped back and let the people take over the TV stations, let the people, until the forces that are protecting the empire, protecting the 1%, protecting the ruling class step back, we can't get anywhere. So I think it is actually pretty smart and pretty fortuitous to include everybody in this idea that we are the 90%. Something that is happening, that's really dynamic, happening right now in New York with Occupy Sandy, in the wake of Superstorm Sandy and the kind of slowness that Red Cross and FEMA are in getting to some of these poorer neighborhoods. And there's a very blue-collar, very conservative neighborhood out in Rockaway that would not consider themselves part of the Occupy movement, but they are very grateful that the Occupy Wall Street movement has organized around mutual aid. Mutual aid is love, and they're taking care of their neighbors. They're filling a huge void. Mm-hmm. So I think it is a smart branding tool, to use a verb of Madison Avenue. To me, I still believe this is the most exciting thing to come along in my lifetime. I'm 43 years old, and when I'm editing footage, or when I'm with friends in different cities from the Occupy movement, I look at their faces and I see them as part of something that history is going to remember as a really positive force in the world. We live in a generation and in a time where people expect instant gratification and people expect things to happen really instantly. But if you look at, say, any civil rights struggle or any human rights struggle, any struggle for social justice, things just don't happen that quickly, right? There's too much force and interest in keeping things the way they are by the people, the 1% or the 1% of the 1% who benefit from keeping things the way they are.
Great. Thank you so much, Lance.
All right. Thank you.
You're listening to This Rhetorical Life. I'm your host, Ben Kiebrick, introducing you to a response to the interview we just had with Dennis Traynor Jr. This audio comes from the Four Seas Conference in Las Vegas, where I met in a busy hallway with Deborah Mutnick of LIU Brooklyn. Mutnick had just listened to the podcast on Occupy Wall Street and had some interesting responses that help extend the analysis and that brings the discussion into her work with students and to the field of rhetoric and composition. She starts by talking about what is unique about the movement.
You know, what was so interesting about Occupy, as Todd Gitlin says, is the rapidity of the movement. Who would have believed that within a month or less than a month, this would have become such an international struggle and would have bonded. And I think part of its success was its very deliberate identification with Tahrir Square, with the Arab Spring, with Wisconsin the previous spring in the United States. And then the brilliance of the slogan, the 99%.
And Mutnick talks about how this slogan identifies with people, especially in our contemporary moment, with the loss of the middle class and a list of other problems and inequalities.
The combination of the cost of health care, the cost of insurance, the debt that's saddling everybody in terms of credit cards, mortgages, student tuition, student loans. It's an unbearable weight, and I think that this identification with the 99% is a testament to the anger that people feel about the situation that we are in the United States at this point, this inequality of wealth.
Munt goes on to describe a PBS show that aired that summer, just before Occupy had took off. And it claimed that despite record levels of inequality, people were feeling okay about their situation. But Mutnick describes how the Occupy Wall Street movement came along, changing the national conversation, and with it the national understanding of people's place within an unequal and unjust system.
About it. And suddenly, with the campaign of Occupy Wall Street, there was a recognition of oneself, right? No, things aren't great. Things are really pretty bad. There's a lot of unemployment. There's a lot of people who can't pay their mortgages. There are a lot of foreclosures. Students can't afford to go to college anymore. And locating the problem in the 1%. So I don't know that the analysis went as deep as it needs to go, but there was the understanding that there's this 1% that's making huge profits at the expense of everybody else.
And I asked her if she thought that the framing of the 99% versus the 1% contributed to this new social understanding.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, again, it's the use of language to communicate a very complex idea and to engage people at the level not only of their intellect, which is important, but also at the level of their material experiences in the world.
Mutnick was asked to write a guest article for Forbes magazine about the movement, and in it she described reading historical documents about our country's founding with students, and as she writes, wrestling with the contradiction in 1776 between the rhetoric of equality and the reality of African enslavement. She commented in our interview that
this question about the 1% and the 99% is really the history of our country.
And Mutnick continues to explain how we've been trying to achieve the rhetoric of equality put into these early documents in our nation's history.
The values that are inscribed into the Declaration of Independence, and that many people think we have won, but we never have won them entirely. And that struggle has taken so many different forms, and it's a long struggle. I think that's the other thing that Trainor talks about that's really important to remember, is that these are long struggles. And that I think, you know, as I've been working on these kinds of issues, and particularly with students, I think that helping students and all of us to understand that these struggles don't end. It's not as though we're going to come to a golden age. It's not as though we're going to come to a time when everything's fixed. That's not the way history or human consciousness works. We're going to come to a point of other contradictions that we're going to have to resolve, but we need to have contradictions that don't imperil us, and I think that that's what really differentiates this moment from other moments that we faced in the past.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
This Rhetorical Life is brought to you by graduate students in the Composition and Cultural Rhetoric program at Syracuse University. Executive producers of This Rhetorical Life are Ben Kiebrick and Allison Hitt, with additional production and editing from Carrie Ann Soto, Tamara Isak, and Seth Davis.